Good morning. Thank you so much for inviting me to come back and talk to you again this year about what we do at ADA. Cheryl's right. ADA was started as a group with a group of women from a faith community and a group of women in recovery, which is also a spiritual process, coming together to create a place where initially women could come and dry out. It was just a house of hospitality where women could come and retreat essentially from the lives they had been living and begin to look inward and begin to look at the sources of support around them to lead different lives. Over time, ADA has become not just a house of hospitality, but also we're a licensed residential substance abuse treatment program. We've got credentialed people on our staff, and we're subject to all the oversight that the State Department of Health Services wants to impose on us, which is getting more and more. But at its core, what we are women who are reaching out to other women who are in tremendous pain from addiction. The women who come to ADA have experienced usually 20 years of addiction, starting in late childhood and by the time they're in their 30s, the hard life that they've been living has taken a toll on them emotionally, spiritually, financially, on their family relationships, on their employment opportunities. In any aspect of life that you might look around you and find comfortable, they look around and find pain. So what we do in providing a home down on First Street, first and foremost, is to provide stability and security on a daily basis for women who have not had that experience in their lives in some time. The women who come to us typically have that 20-year history of drug and alcohol abuse beginning in their late childhood, which also means that they probably have had unhealthy relationships. Their experience of sexual relationships has been difficult. Their experience of family relationships has been fraught with shame and with many of the other unhealthy aspects that we find in dysfunctional families of origin. So when someone comes to us, what we do first of all is try to establish a zone of safety for a woman to recognize that some of the aspects of her life have been unsafe, and what we can do to create safety for a woman that allows her then to put down some of the defense mechanisms that she's used to stay alive. So we never tell somebody to put some habit or some personal characteristic away until she's ready to do that, but what we try to do is to demonstrate that this is a safe place to be able to be released of those things, that you can feel the comfort and the safety of being able to put down manipulative behavior, entitlement thinking, aggressive strategies that have probably been successful in the street world but are not terribly successful in the recovery world. So what we want to do is to offer that opportunity to women to be able to put down the things that have caused such tremendous pain, and the strategies that we offer are tools for recovery. We ask women to look at honesty as being the foundation of recovery, and honesty becoming honest with yourself and honest with the people around you. That's a difficult concept to get across to people who have been scheming and strategizing on how to survive. You do what you need to do on the street in an addicted world to maintain that relationship with the addictive substance. So we ask women to take a look at those things that are unhealthy in their lives and put them down and adopt new ways of being, new ways of doing things. To surround yourself with women who are giving and who can offer support and can offer some structure and some help. We encourage women to follow a 12-step program of recovery, which many of you know. You host a Phoenix group here during the week, which our women attend the Phoenix group. But the 12-step process is a great spiritual journey which allows people to acknowledge that there is a higher power in their lives, and a higher power can restore lives to sanity. And that by doing that, you offer that reflection of honesty and sanity to people around you, and it creates a healthy environment. One of the things that is kind of difficult for people to understand, unless they've been privileged, as I have been for the last 12 years, to work in this area, is that this is not a bad patch that somebody's going through when they come to residential substance abuse treatment. We're like the highest level of care that you can have outside a locked unit or a prison. So what we offer is a place where long-standing patterns of dysfunctional behavior we can try in 30 days, which is a terribly small period of time, to offer a glimpse of what could be different and to introduce women to a different way of being. So it's not a bad patch. I remember talking to a woman one day, and I said to her, well, tell me about a time in your life when things were good. And she got that kind of faraway look that we get when we remember something wonderful. And she told me about her apartment. There were curtains. There was food in the refrigerator. She had everything set up just the way she wanted it. And when I asked her how long she was able to maintain that, it was 6 weeks. She had been able to maintain the life of her dreams for 6 weeks. And yet that was the place she could go inside herself to create a safe, wonderful retreat for herself. So when we talk to women who are coming into treatment, frequently they have not had a period of stability or a period of, we complain in our world about, gosh, I'm in a rut. You know, everything's the same. You know, I get up, I go to the grocery store, I go to my job, I call my friends, I go out to lunch, we're in a rut, we do the same thing over and over again. Well, the rut that so many women who come to us have been in is a scary, terrible place where there's only pain, and the thing that ameliorates that pain is ultimately causing greater, longer-term pain, drug and alcohol use. The thing that provides some sort of respite from that initially is drug and alcohol use, and yet that is in effect the thing that is killing the soul of the person in front of you. So what we provide at ADA is that safe place for women to retreat from the world with the guidance of women in recovery who come to us from 12-step programs across our community and from licensed chemical dependency counselors who provide 30 hours of group plus an hour of individual counseling at the intensive residential treatment level. We provide a beacon that shows a different way of life. And Ilsa has been with us at our art group. The Galveston Art Center sends Linda Urkeley Musso and some of the other women from the Art Center come in and do a creative expression group every Thursday afternoon. Our clients also go to yoga. And I know some people think that's, kind of crazy. You're talking about indigent women and you're taking them off to yoga. Well, the thing is that yoga is not only a way for women to become aware of their own bodies in a healthy way, but it is also a way that they can, when they leave treatment, continue to find peace and serenity and learn how to soothe themselves without the use of chemicals. We also have occupational therapy. We have a PhD, Suzanne Peliquins. A lot of you in this room probably know her. She comes and does a group every two groups on Tuesday. One is a creative self-expression group, and the other is a basic living skills group, where in the first group, they use found materials to create items that dream boxes. One of the best exercises I ever saw done with an occupational therapist was I observed the group, and they had strings taped down on the table, and they were making macrame bracelets. Again, a cliche to some people. But frankly, in watching this, it was a very complex multi-step process where the clients had to follow probably five different, independent, but related steps in order to tie the knots, flip the strings, tie more knots, flip the strings. They were incredibly frustrated by this task, and it was making them angry. And they were very frustrated by the complexity of the task in front of them. And yet the occupational therapist kept working with them, saying, now do this, now do this, now do this. And then she stopped them when they got about an inch worth of knots done. And she had them take a step back and look at what they had done. And she reminded them about how frustrated and how angry they had and how unfamiliar this had all seemed to them. And then she related that to their own recovery. And she said, you have begun a process that feels uncomfortable, that feels stressful, that feels like it's unproductive and it's messy and it doesn't look right and your people are telling you things to do and you don't understand how it all works together. And yet look, within the space of an inch, how everything has smoothed out. You've learned the process. You've taken something that was a little bit messy at the beginning and turned it into a uniform process so that it feels comfortable and it's something you can do on your own now. You understand you do this, you do this, you do this, you do this, and the payoff is you have a bracelet at the end of it. But she tied it, and so that it's that way with every recovery. Every Tuesday there is a recovery strategy that is expressed through the arts. And furthermore, after that they do a group that is stuff like how to use the phone book to find resources, how to fill out a job application, how to role play a stressful situation that might come up in an employment setting, how to talk to family members about what you're feeling, how to use I statements to support what you want rather than becoming frustrated and rather than acting out in a way that only creates more abrasive tension. So we do a lot in that 30 days when someone's with us. And frankly, women who have a co-occurring mental illness may stay longer. They may come and stay for up to 60 days. Because we want women to be able to, it's not very long. And it doesn't take people as far as we'd like to take them, but it is, as we are an indigent program, we are our hands are tied by the amount of funding that we have. And then to make you feel a little bit better, we do pass off our clients, step down then to an outpatient treatment program through the Gulf Coast Center so that when they finish with us, they go on to the Gulf Coast Center for outpatient treatment. And we hope that as their days in treatment decrease and time in treatment decreases, their interest, activity, and attachment to 12-step programs is increasing. So every client is encouraged during her time with us to get a sponsor and to work with that sponsor in actually doing the work of the 12 steps, which after you acknowledge there's a higher power and ask that that higher power enter your life, you begin a process of soul searching and do what's called an inventory, and you acknowledge the things that in a financial, spiritual, sexual way that have, you make a fearless and searching moral inventory and share that with your sponsor or with another person. Then you attempt to make redress where to do so would not cause further harm. And then finally, the last steps are what I call the lather, rinse, and repeat part. So it's like shampooing. You know, what it says on the shampoo bottle, you lather, rinse, and repeat. Well, that's what you do with recovery, too. You keep doing it time and time again, and it becomes ingrained. And I said, one of the women who comes Friday afternoons and does an introduction to 12-step stuff is a woman who's been in AA for 25 years or more, and she said it's pretty hard to fall off the wagon if you're part of the wagon. So she says you want people to become, that the people, places, and things in your life become affiliated more with recovery than they are with the old ways. You know, when I first talked about coming here last year, I thought about talking from a sociological point of view about why voluntary associations, as we moved from small societies to larger societies, we all need to find voluntary groups that we associate with. And we, you know, there's Durkheim out there who talks to us about voluntary associations, and there's a lot of normlessness in society, and so you find your group. Here's our group today. We're here together. But I also thought, you guys are also a pretty intellectual group as well, and you like poetry. So I brought you an E.E. Cummings poem today. And I brought you the Good Samaritan, because I also know that you are talking about service this month and how you reach out into the community, which you do so beautifully in so many different ways. But I brought you, and many of you may be familiar with this poem, but it says, "A man who had fallen among thieves lay by the roadside on his back, dressed in 15th-rate ideas, wearing a round jeer for a hat. Fate, per a somewhat more than less emancipated evening, had in return for consciousness endowed him with a changeless grin, whereon a dozen staunch and leal citizens did graze at pause, and then, fired by hyper-civic zeal, sought newer pastures, or because swaddled with a frozen brook of pinkest vomit out of eyes which noticed nobody, he looked as if he did not care to rise. One hand did nothing on the vest, its wide-flung friend clenched weakly dirt, while the mute trouser fly confessed a button, solemnly inert. Brushing from whom the stiffened puke, I put him all into my arms and staggered, banged with terror through a million, billion, trillion stars." And I thought about what Betts read to us, and I thought, that could you have a more beautiful expression of that, that we pick people up, we carry them into the stars, and we know that we're all connected. And so we can't afford to pass people by, because they're us. It's us in another form. We're all connected. And that's my personal philosophy about why I do what I do, and I feel so lucky to be able to do it. I get to do this not only because it's an outgrowth of my personal philosophy, but I get to do it for my job, which I'm just so grateful for. And thank you for the opportunity of sharing that with you today. Do any of you have any questions for me about what we do or how we do it?
Kelly, I have a question.
Yes.
What about homeless women who don't have a place after the day?
Well, we work to... If they have a co-occurring mental health condition, then we can work with the Gulf Coast Center. They have a permanent housing program. Their transitional housing program no longer provides residence on Broadway for women, but they do for men. But they do still have the permanent housing part, so we work with that. We also have had a lot of success with the women's shelter in Houston, the women's center in Bonita House, and we are working with the Red Shield program at the Salvation Army, which they're opening next week, the new shelter. And we're also going to be providing, Major Harvey Johnson and I have been talking about providing a group every week from one of our counselors to go over there and talk to the people who are seeking service at Salvation Army about what addiction is and what kind of services are available in our community for people who are ready to change.
Yeah, now I met some woman, did one woman say that she was there for 90 days?
That's Brazoria County Drug Court. We work with Drug Court from Brazoria County, and I'm pleased to report that I believe Galveston County this spring is going to be able to initiate its own drug court. And it's going to, in Galveston County, we're incorporating veterans and mental health issues in our drug court, which is looking at providing alternatives to long-term incarceration for people but through treatment and an 18-month process through drug court. And that's what these women are involved in.
Yeah, but what was amazing to me is one of the people, I was sort of asking people when I was there, she said she was there for 90 days, and she said she didn't really want to come, but she didn't like the program.
You know, that is so true. Almost everybody who comes to us is at a pre-contemplation or contemplation stage of change. And pre-contemplation means just, it's the fancy, I'm not ready for this yet. But we had a counselor one time who said, you can lead a horse to water, you can't make him drink, but you can sure try to make him thirsty. And sometimes it's CPS that's making people thirsty, sometimes it's probation, sometimes it's drug court, sometimes it's pressure from families. You know, people don't necessarily want to change. Think about it yourself. Change is not necessarily, we don't choose change. Change is thrust on us most of the time. And you're terrified. You're putting down the people, places, and things that you know, and you don't think life's going to be fun anymore.
So they don't actually get to dry out from the throat. They're supposed to have done it before they come. That's kind of what I thought.
Oh no! Well, we are not a detox program.
So the
only things that you really need to detox from medically are opiates, benzodiazepines, and alcohol, and that depends on what most people know what happens to them when they stop using. Things like methamphetamine and cocaine don't have a medical detox component, so they would be coming in probably having used very recently. Same with most alcohol and most benzodiazepines. Depends on the level of those things. You can have serious medical complications from those things, so they would need to be medically detoxed first. But almost everybody who comes in is working with a psychological addiction as well as the physical consequences of stopping using something, but it may not kill you, which is what it would with opiates and benzodiazepines. Yes?
I'm just wondering how you can tell if you're succeeding. Like if someone's, I mean, I'm sure you, as a human being, you can see that progress, but how do you measure it?
Excellent question. We ask ourselves all the time. Okay.
Well, my brother went through a program when he was a teenager.
Okay.
He was in a place for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And my dad had great insurance.
Yeah. There you go.
But, I mean, there were people, kids coming in and out constantly, 30 days and then come out, and it just seemed
okay.
Like...
So, let me start off by saying some of the hard things that people just flat out don't want to hear. This is a chronic relapsing disease. It has a compliance rate very similar to other chronic conditions like diabetes and heart disease, which means that any place between 58 and 70-something percent people will be compliant with the full regimen. And think about that yourself. If your doctor prescribes you high blood pressure medication, do you remember to take it every day? Do you take it as it's instructed? So that we're looking at a compliance rate of about the same as that, but it's because it's a chronic relapsing condition. What we look at in a harm reduction model would be, are we providing people with greater resources to be able to make better decisions? And what does it take to get somebody to a full abstinence where they have... I would say that our rate is probably, the way the state measures it, are you abstinent 30, 60, 90 days after treatment? So what we do is we call our former clients, and we have a couple of events every year where we bring everybody back together to tell their stories. And it's very much like your sharing of joys and sorrows. Around 4th of July, we have an event at St. Michael's up in Lamarck, a potluck dinner, where last year we had close to 100 people come. And they talk about what's happened in the year previous. And talk about, when one woman got up at a recent one and said, I had to come today. It was the day we buried my father. We buried my father this morning. And yet I knew I had to be here tonight because I was part of my family. I had a chance to say goodbye to my father. I had a chance. I sat with the family. I was part of that grieving process. And I never would have done that if I hadn't cleaned up, if I hadn't stopped using. And so for her, the ability to fully express the grief she felt at the loss of her father was only made possible by her ability to stay sober. And so we look for, during treatment, what your question is, what do we do during treatment that makes that possible? Well, we hope to break through those defenses. We hope to break through the things that have been their coping strategies in the past, but we hope to break through those. Denial, defensive behavior, projecting it as someone else's responsibility or problem. We want to break through those. We challenge those things during treatment, and we challenge them to look inward rather than looking outward for solutions. But that you don't have to go in there, in that scary place inside yourself. You don't have to go there alone. You have people to go with you.
Well, it worked for my mother.
That is so good. Well, it does take a long time.
I only had a problem for a short time. He was young. So, it was, you know, these people have been doing it for 20 years. It's a lot harder to break the pattern.
There are many more consequences.
Once they have positive results, it's probably forcing them to continue.
That is true. But the loss, the grief and loss, and the things that people have experienced along the way. I heard a doctor talk one time from the Mayo Clinic, and he said that some of the bravest people he'd ever seen were women in recovery, because they need to acknowledge what the collateral damage is to their families. And to be able to acknowledge that with honesty, accept some of that, and figure out how you're going to move on is a very difficult thing.
I mean, if you're a mother and you've had been on drugs and your child has suffered, and you come sober, that's going to be excruciating pain that you did that to your child.
Absolutely.
Maybe you may want to go back on drugs just to escape that pain. I mean, that's...
Women come to some very difficult days when they're in treatment. A lot of, if so there's CPS involvement, then the question is going to be, are you going to be able to provide a stable home for your children? And some women, within the last year, I sat with a woman who said, if I can't clean up, then I shouldn't get my children back. I shouldn't put my children through this. But what I can tell you that she said those words, how devastating it is to sit with someone who's experiencing that kind of critical decision making. It's a heavy burden. Yes. I left some of our brochures out there, and I put a panel on that brochure that said, if you think you know somebody who has a problem, that you can talk about some of these things. And that is the way to do that is difficult. I'm not going to kid you about that. But what you want to do is maybe talk about how you feel about the consequences of how someone's behavior is affecting you. And then you can say, look, I know somebody who's a licensed counselor, and you can sit down with this person. And the screening and assessment process for addiction involves the person who's addicted giving information to a counselor, who can then present that back in terms of norms and can say, people who have responded like this in the past typically meet diagnostic criteria for substance abuse, either in cocaine dependence or in alcohol dependence or hallucinogens or whatever the abused substance is. But they can say, and here's where help is and how you can address that. But there's a visual tool that when you're talking about, if you're in a codependent situation with someone who is addicted, then you're both leaning like this. So when one person stands up, the other person may fall. So we want to make sure that the addicted person gets the help they need, but also the person who loves that person. So there's Al-Anon. And Al-Anon really is a wonderful, wonderful place for family members. I have followed an Al-Anon program in other years in the past and worked the steps as an Al-Anon member. And what it taught me was how not to take on another person's responsibility, but let the logical consequences fall where they would. That I can't fix everything. It's not my job to fix everything. That I need to learn that I didn't cause, cure, or control this disease, and that I can't provide all answers for all people. But that's a pretty difficult thing to do if you're a fixer. And I'm a natural-born fixer. So it's very difficult for me to admit that I don't... When I talk to my kids, I come up with solutions. I'm a solution-oriented person. It's my job. But that's really hard to step away from when you love somebody and to give them the power and the authority to make the decisions in their own lives. And that's one of the hardest challenges we face when we love people who are hurting themselves. So look at that. Give me a call. I'd be happy to talk to anybody who has any questions about that. I can put you in touch with... I am not a licensed chemical dependency counselor. I'm just a paper pusher and money person. But I can put you in touch with people who can provide that kind of help. Well, thank you very much for being such a wonderful congregation today.